So today is going to be a little bit different than usual. Usually we have people come on our show and I interview them. Really consider these interviews, I guess. It's more like conversations, but whatever. Usually we have people come on our show, but today I'm going to be interviewed and I'm going to be the guest. And we're going to post it on this feed. You're going to hear it. So a little bit of context. I've been wanting to talk about tea and supplements for a while. And if you know me personally, it is pretty fucking shocking that we've gone 30 episodes now, and I haven't done an episode where I've really talked about either of those very much, considering how much both tea and supplements take up in my life. Like, they take up a lot of space in my life. So we haven't done that. So I've kind of considered doing like a solo episode where I just talk about this. That was actually kind of top of mind recently. And then right around that time, Armand, who had went on his podcast before, the Play Hard podcast, he hit me up and was like, dude, let's do a round two. I want to talk about tea and I want to talk about supplements. And I was like, you know what? Why don't we do that? And I'm just going to post it on my feed too. And that's what we're doing. So today you'll be listening to me have a jam session with the great, the powerful Armand Uno. Armand is an early stage startup founder and the host of the Play Hard podcast, where he interviews entrepreneurs each week about the habits and the hobbies they use to combat stress, burnout, and keep their goddamn sanity. And we're going to be going into quite a lot about that one, and some other things as well, including the art of podcasting and being a good interviewer, the long-term impact of Adderall and caffeine use, battling an autoimmune condition as an entrepreneur, the science practice gap, supplements and nootropics for ADHD, the lack of transparency in the supplement industry. There's a lot of fucking snake oil and bullshit out there. We're going to get into that. A deep dive into the traditional Chinese gung fu style of making tea, how tea can be part of a mindfulness practice, and some of my recent favorite movies, books, TV shows, and lots more. This was our second episode together. The first one on his show, we dove into my life story, which I'm sure some of you guys have heard before. But if you haven't, highly recommend checking that one out. Both of those will be in the show notes. He also recently had a previous guest of ours, Seth Erickson, on, and they went into some areas that we didn't even get into. Like, I had no idea Seth had these like crazy scuba dive stories and stuff, which were pretty nuts. And I'm sitting there listening to this, like, why the hell did we not go there? But give that a listen too. I'll include the link in the show notes as well. But anyway, let's dive into this one. I bring you the great and the powerful Armand Uno on Play Hard Podcast.
Yeah, so for the listener that might not remember, episode 19, Josh Boone, honestly, fan favorite. I had a lot of people comment on that to me, either in person over text, just because of how kind of real we get with the fact that most people get told that in your 20s, you're supposed to be working as hard as you can and saving up and building your life so that in your 40s and 50s, you can kind of chill, like you're set for your family and your 30s and all this. And we both kind of were like, that's kind of bullshit. Like, you should probably focus on being a good person and like enjoying your life in your 20s. Cause if you push that off, that's only gonna happen later. And you still have to go through that kind of work, or you just can spend the rest of your life not really liking yourself, which sounds miserable to me. But yeah, it was a good episode. I enjoyed it a lot, and thanks for coming back, dude.
Hell yeah, anytime, man. I had a good time. I think the last episode, I re-listened to it yesterday just to make sure we didn't go over the same ground. I have the memory of a goldfish, so I'm like, I don't know what we even talked about other than the big bullet points. But I think I started the conversation by being like, yeah, I was on a couple podcasts this week. I didn't really enjoy myself. But yours is one of the most enjoyable I've been on. So this is when he asked me to do a round two. I'm like, fuck yeah, let's go on and do it. It's amazing. There's like 2 million podcasts out there, and the amount that I would probably listen to is like not very much, like most people are just not, they're not good at it. Have you been on a lot of other people's podcasts?
I have. And what I've noticed, I've been on friends podcasts for fun. Those were really enjoyable because it was like legit just friends chopping it up and it was more entertaining. But I have been on others, it's interview style. I would say the biggest piece of feedback that I get that separates me, and I think is what people are looking at and talking to, and anyone who's looking to start an interview podcast can use this, is they ask questions to get through their questions. They don't really like ask questions to listen and expand on those questions. Like one of the best pieces of advice I saw from, are you familiar with Dax Shepard, Armchair Expert?
I haven't listened to the show, but I've heard good things about it.
I really like that podcast. What I have at the top of my episode prep for every episode, number one, in bright bold red, hit record. That's the first thing. Number two, it's what Dax said. So when he went on Smartless, it's like his other friends, like Will Arnett, Jason, who's the guy who did Ozark? I forget his last name always.
Not sure.
And then Sean Hayes. So they all have a podcast together, and their first episode was Dax because he was, 2 years into the game, knew a lot better, helped them out. And what he said was, you should prep for if your guest is a dud, but if you can sense that they run, let them run. And that's probably like how I've done every single interview. Like I do as much prep as I can so that I'll have minimum 45 minutes worth of a conversation if I have to carry the conversation. But if I feel like the guest, like in your episode, we hardly went over the stuff that I wrote down just because I was like, okay, this guy is really good at talking and his stories are very entertaining. Like, let's just go along with this. And I think that's something that hosts could really improve on, is not just asking questions to ask questions. Like, having a set of questions is important. Don't get me wrong, but don't just be married to them.
Yeah, and there's been some that I've been on where, we got a really good vibe going and we're going to some really interesting spot. And then they're like, oh, shit, shit, shit. And they're like going back to their cue cards and, and they're just like, oh, okay, well, what about this? And I'm like, dude, we had a good thing going. Like, even me listening to, like, I was enjoying the conversation. This was good. And then you just like turned a freight train around, like, to go in a different direction. And, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's their show. They can navigate it however they want. If they want to go in that direction, that's fine. But I felt like there could have been a natural bridge there that wasn't so abrupt. And that happens all the time in podcasts I listen to where they got a really good train of thought going and then it just like veers somewhere else. And I'm like, no, I wanted you to spend more time, play in that area a little longer, like let that linger a little bit. Sometimes that just happens, like with Joe Rogan, it's just ADHD, like you just you go and I'm guilty of that. There's been times when I've been editing my stuff and I listen back, I'm like, man, that was a good thing. I should have lingered on that a little longer. It
I
happens,
do that
but
too.
yeah, and I
Do you
think
ever
that's
listen back
fine.
and go like, oh, this is what, if I were to be in this moment again, these are the questions I would ask. Just
Oh
kind of like,
yeah,
yeah.
dude,
I
all
think
the
that's
time.
really helpful for
Yeah,
podcasters
and
too.
it's a learning experience. It's like everything that I've done, like Jesus, man, I think back all the sales meetings and shit that I've been in over the years. I just cringe about like the questions I asked or how I went about it. But that's growth. If you don't cringe at like shit that you said a year or two ago, it's like you're not growing.
Dude, my first few cold calls, I had a guy tell me that he was like, I can tell you're reading from a script. I had another guy pick up the phone and be like, goddamn robo dialers. Like he
Oh
thought
my
I was an
God.
automated voice. That one hurt more than the script, because at least the other guy was talking to me. This dude straight up thought I was a robot.
Oh
But
God. Dude, I
yeah,
got horror
you look
stories for
back on
days.
that.
But I mean, that's everyone, I'm in a position where, most of the people I deal with are senior in their career or they're founders or they're CEOs or whatever. And I've had so many conversations with people that by all accounts, you'd be like, wow, you're a badass. Like, you've got this crazy life. But then they'll tell me, like, they still every once in a while just cringe at shit that they've said over the years. And, they still do that all the time. And it's just like it never really goes away. You just get kinder to yourself and you have more empathy for yourself. But yeah, it's the same thing. I think last conversation we talked about that, like that kind of voice in your head that's always like you could be doing more or whatever. Like it never really fully goes away. But
Also, that
I mean,
cringe is growth. It's kind of like not pleasant sign, but a sign of growth nonetheless. Like if you can look back and say, wow, I would have handled that so much differently or more maturely now, then you can look back and say, okay, so I have come a long way, because that's not what I would do today.
Yeah. And so much of that for me with my mental health has just been like, holy shit. I was like really fucking manic. You know, I didn't realize I had, you know, I have bipolar. I didn't realize I was bipolar. So, you know, I was not only not on medication for that, but I was taking things that actually made it worse pretty significantly. So, I mean, that's probably a good segue into the supplements here in a minute. But like, I look back at that even a couple of years ago and I'm like, oh shit. Like, you know, I'm not very happy with how I came off. Yeah. Like, I must have came in like this, like, there's this moment through history. I forget who it was, but somewhere I read about this moment where, not equating myself to Hitler, but it's funny. There's this moment in history where, like, Mussolini was having a talk with Hitler, right? Like, when they were, like, you know, buddies. And he's like, I think I'm going to break the band up. Like, I think we're going to pull out of this. And he was really nervous, really nervous. He didn't know how the conversation was going, because Hitler could just be like, I declare war on you. Like, you know, it's really, really nervous. So they did this. He spent all this time preparing and he was really anxious. And all of a sudden, Hitler busts through the fucking door and just starts manically like going on a rant for like 2 hours and like doesn't stop talking. And Mussolini's just sitting there like, what the fuck is happening? And he doesn't know what to do. And then Hitler's like, we're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to do this. Awesome. And then he just like leaves and Mussolini's like, what the fuck just happened? Like, because Hitler was super fucking high on amphetamines, just like manic off his rocker, like came in just like an explosion. And like Mussolini didn't even know what to do. And like, I felt like I was kind of like that sometimes when I was, you know, and I have my agency, I just come in like all manic, like super high on like Adderall and caffeine and on like some manic cycle. And I look back, I'm like, oh my God. Oh. You know, but it's a learning experience, you know?
Yeah.
You figure it out. So,
dude, I was going to say, first of all, this is a great segue because I did want to, we talked extensively about your company and your experience, like your ventures in the last episode. So for the listeners, go ahead, check it out. It'll be in the show notes. But what I did want to talk about is you do mention how you've had run-ins with ADHD, bipolar, and anxiety throughout your career. Like, how did that kind of, the stress of entrepreneurship, you know, fuel, or how is it managing that through the stress of being an entrepreneur? Because I can imagine, so sometimes you're taking substances like Adderall, but that kind of amphetamine does, like, side effects are psychosis, mania, things like that. Like, how did you deal with that when you're so stressed starting an agency at, like, in your early mid-20s?
I think about this a lot because, like, I am really, really hard on myself. Really hard on myself. I'm very empathetic with other people. And I'm almost too empathetic, which is something that I'm actually learning. There's a great book, highly recommended, if you're kind of, if you A, deal with any autoimmune issues, or B, any serious mental health issues, and particularly if you're someone like myself who's like, constantly feels like they have to be responsible for not only themselves, but everybody around them. They're an overachiever. They overwork themselves. They're really hard on themselves. If you exist in that you know, spectrum, there's a book that Dr. Gabor Mate just came out with called The Myth of Normal. And it's kind of like he's older. I think he's like 78. So this is kind of like his magna opus of everything. And it's really helped me a lot. But you know, so through reading that book, I've kind of been like reprocessing a lot of these things and looking back at like the whole timeline of, you know, where my mental health issues stem from and how deeply rooted they are and how much of that, you know, plays into the entrepreneurship and then how much of it is kind of like comorbid. And I would say ultimately, like, I constantly ask myself, how much of the struggle would I have just as an entrepreneur by default, and how much of it is extremely exacerbated by the mental health issues, and how much of the mental health issues are baseline default to like I would have no matter what I did in my life, and how much of it is fueled and greatly amplified by the feast and famine of being an entrepreneur? Because a lot of these mental health issues, actually stem from a lack of feeling of security in early childhood. And these like ADHD and some of these other symptoms can basically be like coping mechanisms that your brain starts to form around due to feeling like you're in an insecure environment. And anxiety disorders, things like fibromyalgia, a lot of these stem from a lot of that, which is what I'm, you know, been learning the last couple of years with going to the Cleveland Clinic and then people like Dr. Gabramate. So I don't know. You know, I look at my mental illness happy stack, if you will, and it's pretty daunting. And my baseline reality is very, very difficult on a day-to-day basis because I not only have those mental health issues, but I also have an autoimmune condition that sometimes makes it hard for me even to get out of fucking bed. So I'm there in bed with severe inflammation to the point where I have really bad brain fog and I'm tired and I'm fatigued and I don't have the energy to do anything. Yet I have that voice in my head that's just like, you're fucking being lazy. You need to get up, you need to do that. And the problem is that you're always kind of like an addict. You're always looking at like that metaphorical bottle of Adderall and like ibuprofen and like caffeine staring at you being like, if you took a bunch of ibuprofen, you could get the inflammation down. You would get the brain fog down. If you took the Adderall, you could focus more clearly and you could do the things you need to do. And if you took the caffeine, you'd have the energy to be able to complete all your tasks. And they're sitting there, they're staring at you. And, you know, but you know, if you do that, it has severe consequences. And it revs that engine back up and it actually makes it way worse because what you're doing is, I think the old adage is like, you know, drinking today, like robs you of happiness tomorrow. It's like, it's the same concept where it's like, you're giving up, you know, efficiency today. It's like, you know, it's like in a video game, you use like, you know, the extra power up or whatever. It's like, you can do that. But in this case, it has severe consequences. And
but it's,
you
like,
know,
your character gets weaker in the next few levels if you do that kind of thing.
Exactly. So it's just like, I have had, you know, I occasionally do, I don't really have a lot of caffeine these days. I try to limit it as much. Like, honestly, like the tea that I'm going to be making today, you know, it is actually non-caffeinated. It's actually pretty cool. It's from a small farm and they actually process these tea leaves that are similar to tea, but they process it like normal tea. It's pretty cool. I'll show you in a bit. But like, I'm trying to minimize my caffeine. I'm trying to minimize any of my uppers stimulants because like I've just found over the years that baseline, even if it's, I'm not nearly as effective, you know, grinding, it creates a better baseline that I can function more in the long term, you know? So it's fucking hard because again, I grew up in.
It's like the output is multiplied, but so is your so is your time to burn out.
Oh yeah.
Like what you can do is so much shortened, but what you put out is heightened. So it's like, all right, how do I want to balance this sort of thing?
Yeah. And occasionally like, you know, my partner, she was over in the UK for work like 2 weeks ago. She was gone for a week. And there was this night where like, I don't know. Like I try not to stay. I'm a night owl and I try to like sleep a normal schedule these days. Cause again, I found that the gains, the negative aspects of staying up late, actually, even though I enjoy it more, are actually worse for me. And you know, on a consistent basis, but there was this night where like, I just kind of was like really vibing with this project I was working on. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to make some tea. I'm going to be upstairs. I'm going to have all these moody lights. If you're watching a video, I got all these like lights going and it's just like, you know, it's chill.
It's definitely a vibe.
I'm going to have some lo-fi in the background. I might crank some Nine Inch Nails super loud and I'm just going to stay up and I'm just going to do some deep work. And that was fucking fun, you know, but I went into it with intention being like, yeah, I'm not going to do this for a while.
That's the thing. And I was going to say, sometimes there are people. So like my brother is someone who he does his most productive and creative work at night. But he also tries to set himself a good kind of routine. And he knows if he stays up too late and he's got to get up the next morning, that's just not going to be a good day. Like no one functions well on little sleep. Well, I'm not going to say no one, but most people don't function well on little sleep. So I think that what you said about the intention of knowing, okay, tonight, because I'm feeling it right now, because I have the right mood and I know I'm going to be getting the right work done, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
How would you say that compares to, do you ever have days where you stare at those bottles and you go, all right, today I'm taking Adderall. It's not something I'm going to do long term, but I got to get something done.
It hasn't in a long time. I still have like a very small stash of Adderall that I keep like in my like break in case of emergency, like zombie apocalypse. Like emergency. I need to just function at max capacity kind of thing. But the older I get and the more time I have away from taking it, the more I realize that even if like zombie apocalypse situation would happen, I actually don't think I would want to take it. Because I actually think it would distort my decision making. And I have things that I can take that are a lot better, but more subtle and less, so to answer your question, no, not anymore. There is that little kind of peak of a voice in the back of my head being like, you know, you could take that, you could bust this out. But at the same time, like, I know that the downsides of that are far more. And there's other things like, you know, I got Suproxy here and L-tyrosine that kind of basically are like a healthier, more sustainable Adderall that I can take, pretty much on a daily basis and not really have any sort of issues with. So, you know, I have those things that help. But, you know, particularly with the autoimmune condition, like my health just being so up and down.
What is the condition, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, so I have mast cell activation syndrome, and basically there's a lot of, it's insane how I've been to probably like 20 different specialists and nobody could quite figure out what my problem was.
Yeah.
I actually had a couple doctors think it was just psychosomatic and I was just making it up. And I kind of stopped going to doctors around 2016 when I left my agency because everyone just kept telling me like it's stress. Like it's stress that is causing these issues, which was partially true, but there was an underlying condition that was making it a lot worse. So then I still had issues on the road. I had less issues on the road. I think we talked about that actually when I was in St. Petersburg the second time. My health was really, really bad. I just kept drinking because nothing made it better. Like nothing made it better. And I now know why, but I eventually got referred to the functional medicine department at the Cleveland Clinic, and I've been working with them, and it ended up being early. And again, this goes back to childhood thing. It ended up being early childhood exposure to mold, and a certain portion of the population, I think it's like 20%, cannot make antibodies to mold. So like if you and I were in, a building with, you know, severe mold for like a month, you know, we both might have upper respiratory infections or like a sinus infection or something like that, right?
The normal stuff.
Your body would process it, get rid of it, and you'd probably be fine. Me, like, it just doesn't get rid of it. It goes to my liver can't process it, it gets funneled back, and it's just in this cycle. And then what happens is your body starts releasing mast cells because it's like, hey, there's a foreign pathogen in here, there's a foreign toxin, we need to get rid of it, but it can't get rid of it. So it creates this autoimmune loop, and then the mast cells then send out histamines, which is, you know, allergic response. And then what happens is you constantly have this allergic response that just kind of compounds, and it creates all these other health issues. Next thing you know, you have, you know, you start developing like food sensitivities and all these other things because your body starts thinking that these foods that you're eating are a toxin, and it creates these crazy response. It's nuts, man.
Dude, for how advanced we are in medicine, I've been lately getting this feeling of there is a lot we don't know. What I think is it's kind of like a learning on the fly thing when you realize, like, one thing that's stuck out to me is like how processed our foods have become since the 80s and 90s. Like, we're just now seeing the effects of that on like kids who have grown up with that kind of food their entire lives. So like problems are starting to show up, but it's like, what, you wouldn't have gotten that problem, you know, in the 60s because the food wasn't being processed that way. So like those issues never really came up. So there's definitely a lot of things I'm noticing. I've been in these shoes. So let me know if this is something that resonates with you, where, you know, deep down something is off, yet the professionals are telling you you're totally fine. And kind of like, I don't know why you feel this way. And that's like a really, not only is that tough mentally, but it just kind of throws you in this spiral of like, why am I not normal? And it's very difficult to deal with sometimes.
Well, I mean, let's take a normal example. So let's say, like, you know, you're someone who deals with depression, which I have for most of my life. I thankfully don't deal with it too awful much these days. I think part of that was just being on, medication for bipolar now. So my ups and my downs are significantly leveled. Less extreme. Yeah. I mean, I'm always kind of a sad boy. Like I always feel kind of like an alien. I think that I'll always have that kind of existential loneliness.
But you're not alone in that.
No, absolutely not. But like, I used to be just hardcore depressed. It's suicidal. Yeah. I'm not anymore, thankfully.
I mean, if you checked out the last episode, you'll hear a bit more on that story on how Josh traveled the entire country searching for that something, dude. Searching for the other side. I mean, you sold a multi-million dollar company. You got your check. You got everything that, you know, a lot of people would have wanted, and yet you still felt crushed.
Yeah. It was. There is Tim Ferriss actually wrote at the 4-Hour Workweek. The last chapter, I believe, is called like Filling the Void or something like that. Mm. And it's so funny because in spite of how insanely influential and popular that book was, he routinely says that that's the chapter that he wishes people would reread the most. And it's so interesting to me how like he addresses that. Like that, like once you leave, you're kind of stuck with your own thoughts and your own feelings, and you have to do something about it. And people kind of just didn't pay attention to that. They're like, oh, okay, scale business. I want to make lots of money. But anyway, like let's say somebody goes to the doctor for depression. Most of the time, they're not doing blood work. They're not asking about lifestyle. They're not asking about diet and stuff like that. They might, you know, quickly touch on it. But I mean, even with specialists that I've talked to at the Cleveland Clinic and all of my research that I've done and all the doctors that I've talked to, it's not often. People usually go in there and say, okay, well, you know, ask them a handful of questions and then they'll try them on an SSRI. You know, they're not really digging deep.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, you could just have a vitamin D deficiency. You could have something kind of benign like that, that is really simple. And there's also just, you know, a tremendous amount of lifestyle influences there. And I feel like depression in outside of the context of like clinical depression, where it's a very severe hormonal imbalance. A lot of the time that depression and anxiety is a signal that like something is off, you know? And that's what I've come to terms with for myself. It's like when I'm really anxious.
So like depression and anxiety are not the root problem. They're a symptom of the problem.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's something that, you know, I've had to come to terms with myself. You know, your mileage may vary. I hate when people talk in absolutes, but you know, everything that I'm saying now, it tracks with, you know, Dr. Gabor Mate's research. Again, The Myth of Normal, really recommend that. But it's, We the way that my doctor at the Cleveland Clinic described it is she's like 10, 15 years from now, everything's going to be wildly different. Everything across the board. I went to a GI specialist for a lot of these issues, and I inquired about leaky gut, which is something that has historically been kind of in the pseudoscience, you know, area and whatever. But there's a lot of research with some of the top gut specialists in the world over the last couple of years where they're seeing, okay, gut permeability, this is a thing, you know, this is actually a thing.
My best friend's mom's a nurse and she's been championing that for quite some time. And just now it's starting to be like it's a thing. Like sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why it is. It takes so long for these things to persist, but I guess we're just like naturally resistant to change. Like if you've been practicing something for so long, for so wildly, and then you hear this whole group saying, hey, that's actually not correct. There's like a different way of looking at it. I mean, that's so important to at least consider the differences, but yeah, I guess we're all by nature. I mean, me, myself included, is resistant to change. And the same goes for institutions.
It's considered the science practice gap. So there's a gap between the latest science and the latest treatments and what is actually put into practice. Mm-hmm. And the way that, you know, so like I went to a GI specialist and I asked about it, and I wasn't even saying like, I think I have leaky gut, blah, blah, blah. I was just saying, hey, what is your thoughts on this? I know there's a lot of conflicting opinions online. There is some latest research this seems very promising. What is your thoughts on that? Almost verbatim, it's pretty much how I went about it. She got really weird, really weird. And her tone changed. Everything changed. She's like, that is something, you know, like us doctors, the medical community, we don't really like think that's a thing, you know, like that's not really a thing. And then after in the little, you know, after notes, which most people don't even read, but I went on the my chart and checked it. And she's like, you know, interested in alternative, you know, alternative medicine or whatever. And I was just like, that's, that was, you know, it was very telling what, how she thought about how, what I was saying. And then I went to the doctor at the Cleveland Clinic and they're like, yeah, that's a thing. We treat it all the time. Like we're state-of-the-art medical center. We treat it all the time. That doctor doesn't know what the hell she's talking about. And I'm like, why is that? And she's just explained to me. That doctor probably went to medical school like 20, 30 years ago.
That's what I was going to say. It's a, I have a few friends going to med school, and it takes a long time to become a practicing doctor. I wonder if that's where that gap comes from. Again, I'm not at all close to the medical practice, so I have no idea. I can only speculate. But I wonder if it's you go to med school, then you do your residency, you practice, and by the time you're actually a practicing doctor, you've been doing it for a while, and you're actually treating people, I imagine you're... it's been a while since you went to school. And obviously doctors keep reading, keep researching, and keep up with things. But like, let's say you're not a gut doctor, yet you have a patient asking you about leaky gut. Of course, you're not going to like have the most up-to-date knowledge. That's just not what you're keeping up with. That's not your specialty. You're not like, that's not what you're paid to do.
Yeah. In the case of her, like the original, she's a GI specialist. She's a gut specialist. She should know that. But in general, doctor, yeah, I understand. And the way that I've traced it back is like, it's several generations. A lot of doctor podcasts talk about this all the time, the frustration. I actually had one doctor, Dr. Pulumi Campbell on my podcast, and like she talked about
it. Josh Boone Show, check it out, listener.
Hey. But yeah, like it's she talked about this. It's like that science practice gap. So let's say like, you know, you go to med school and the professor there who is teaching you went to med school, you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
They're very stuck in their ways. And a lot of these tenured professors typically, they can be quite dogmatic and resistant to new research because it goes against what they're doing. So even if the, you know, they may be the most resistant a lot of the times because they have, you know, a very rigid way in which they view the world because they've been doing this so long. So if that, even if you have the latest research, that doctor could be quite resistant to it, and they don't teach you that. And then you go through your residency, you know, med school, your residency, all this other stuff, and then you might not be keeping up with the latest research. And so, like, you're now like two generations behind.
Yeah.
Because not only are you behind on what was, you know, the most up to date when you went to school, but now you're an entire generation removed of that. And so it's just, it's a lot. But, you know, I mean, I've had to figure most of this out on my own. And it's odd going to doctors. I don't want to try and be like that person that goes in there and micromanages the doctor, because I have people do that to me as a consultant. It drives me fucking nuts.
Yeah.
But I have kind of had to go in. I try to be respectful and I try not to tell them, you know, what I want done or any of that stuff. But I do come with a lot of knowledge. And a lot of the time, like until I got to the Cleveland Clinic, I go to these doctors and I would know more often about what was happening in, you know, the latest studies and stuff than they would. And it was very concerning to me. Like that GI specialist, I'm sure, deals with a lot of people that have similar issues that I did. And those patients are not being treated the best way possible. And it really kind of angers me. I couldn't imagine like being in a position where your treatments that your patients could significantly better their lives, and you just don't care. You know, you checked out. And I understand. My sister's a nurse. Medical field is extremely draining, and it can be very draining and demoralizing. I get it. I think the same thing in the entrepreneurship community. Like, you just get really worn down and people kind of just get bored. I see that a lot with people that I consult with. They just kind of lose the will to want to do it anymore, you know? And it just, everything just kind of de-escalates from there. But
so tying it back to a little bit of entrepreneurship, if you were to go back to the you that started the agency in the past, not your current consultancy, but like if you were to start over, what would you do differently to knowing what you know about your own mental health and self, what would you do differently?
Oh, man. So, yeah, I guess if I have to go back, it's one of those things where it's just like, I thought about this a couple times before. It's just those, you know, it's funny little hypotheticals, right? And it's kind of one of those chicken of the egg. Yeah, it's kind of one of those like weird chicken of the egg situations where it's just like, okay, if I knew what I knew now, I wouldn't have done any of that to begin with. So it kind of like I would end up doing something similar to what I'm doing now. But if I had to, so that's the weird thing. It's like, I wouldn't have done it. You know, I just wouldn't have done the agency in the way that I did. I wouldn't have done it with the people that I did. I wouldn't have done the kind of clients, the projects that I did. Everything would have been differently. But at the same time, it's like, if I had, in this hypothetical, I had to do the agency and I had to do all these things. It's like, I think the first thing is I would have really thought a lot harder about my business partners. I think I would.
So it was your environment that kind of also fed into, I guess, I mean, at the same time, like, that's probably where those partners were probably the right partners for you at that time. Or like who you were and where you were at that time. Like your environment was just a reflection of that. Whether you made it yourself or whether your environment kind of put you in that spot, probably both. But that was just you then, and they all kind of fed into each other. Like now you do things the way you do because you have learned about yourself and your mental health and how to manage and balance that.
Yeah, and I learned a tremendous from the partners that I had, both in my business and external partners as well, like other agencies mm-hmm. we partnered with and other people. I learned a lot from a lot of them, but after a certain point, I kind of absorbed what I needed. And then there were some pretty serious negative aspects that I think really derailed not only professionally, but personally as well. So I think, you know, I vet potential partners significantly more. And I think the thing more than anything is an alignment, a kind of moral alignment on priorities. For me, like the North Star is like, do I have to remotely walk on eggshells with this person, or do I feel like we could just go and get beers and just open up and talk like how you and I are, and there's no friction, there's no weird, you know, weird guardedness or anything. That's a huge part of it. Another one is just like, what is their goal? If they just want to scale and make a bunch of money, like that's not my partner, people I want to work with. You know, is it people that want to create a lifestyle business where they know kind of what they want out of life, and this is something that they're passionate about doing as well, and they want to unify that, like the work that they're doing and the lifestyle they want to have, and that's the perfect intersection. Cool, that's somebody I vibe with. And is it also someone who just legitimately wants to keep pushing themselves and experiment and try new and interesting things and kind of push the needle in their industry? Okay, that's another thing that I want to collaborate with that person. If they don't fit any of those, if they don't hit all three of those, then it's just not somebody that I want to partner with.
Yeah.
So that's a huge part of it. And like I said, you know, I had some partnerships in my early 20s that really taught me a lot, and I learned a lot from them, and I'm glad that I met them. But there were other issues, very kind of toxic aspects that either I took on or it amplified toxic aspects of myself. So that would be something. I think the other thing is like I wouldn't probably I would do it fully remote. I wouldn't have had like an office in person. I think that was really instrumental for part of our business, but I think it became kind of a liability because the overhead was kind of like dangling above us at all times. And we had to have more cash flow in. And I think that made us take on projects that we didn't necessarily want to take on just because we had to do payroll and we had to, you know, pay for a big office and a bunch of other stuff. I think I would have kept us a lot leaner and lighter and not had so much financial burden. You know, I think I would have been a lot harder on like work-life balance. It's just so many things that I would do differently. I think I would definitely prioritize my mental health a lot more. I think I would take
it like
a lot of these things
come from knowing yourself and kind of knowing the way that you operate and what's most productive for you.
Yeah. I mean, even if I told myself all these things, I don't think I would have really listened.
Yeah, I think so that's a whole other thing. I think if I were to go back and go to 18-year-old me and be like, dude, you really want to get the most out of these next 4 years? Do a different thing. I would have been like, no, I want to have fun.
Yeah. And I think part of it also was just straight up like my mental health. Like I was unmedicated on certain aspects and I was over-medicated on certain aspects. Like I got diagnosed with ADHD and then I went on Adderall, which helped a lot in one regard, but then with the bipolar, it made it worse. So it's kind of like robbing Peter to pay Paul. And yeah, so that, you know, it made me be able to focus, but also at the cost of making my highs and my manic cycles and my low depressive cycles worse. So it's just kind of like, you know, I mean, that's where, if you want to jump into the supplements, I mean, that's kind of like where this stuff comes in.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue. And that's another thing for anyone looking to get into podcasting. That's how you do it. You find something you're talking about and have it tie seamlessly into your next topic.
Yeah. So really there's a lot that I take. I take literally 55 pills a day. Now,
damn.
About half of that, at least, if not more, is due to autoimmune treatment with the Cleveland Clinic and a bunch of shit that I'm going through.
How many are like natural supplements versus lab made?
It varies. It's kind of like, you know, I mean, there's some like fish oil I'm staring at right now, but most of the stuff that I'm taking may derive from natural sources, but it's highly processed in a good way. So like, you know, it's they are increasing bioavailability and stuff like that. Like, for example, I take this thing called Longvita, which is a type of optimized curcumin, which is, turmeric.
Yeah.
Curcuminoids is kind of like, the extract within turmeric. So if you were to take cooking turmeric, you're not going to get a lot of curcuminoids out of it. You know, you would have to ingest a tremendous amount of turmeric to be able for it to be really significant from a health perspective. I mean, I think any is better than none, but you would have to take a lot. So if you're taking curcumin, which is like 95% curcuminoids, I forget what it is, but you would have to take an enormous amount of turmeric to even get anywhere close to that. So that's that. And then a step further down that line is Longvita, which is optimized to actually cross the blood-brain barrier. And so it actually helps reduce inflammation specifically in the brain. And so it helps a lot with anxiety and brain fog and a lot of other things, because brain inflammation is a significant driver of a lot of that. So you're now three levels deep removed from cooking turmeric that you would normally get. So, there are some things that are straight up synthetic that I've taken over the years, but you know, most of it is kind of that kind of thing. The two for attention that helped me the most is one is called Sobroxy, which is actually derived from a bark, type of bark on a tree. Sobroxy is a dopamine reuptake inhibitor. So if you think about it, an analogy I like to use is like Adderall is kind of like, imagine you got like a leaky pipe, right? And so like what Adderall kind of does is almost like it seals the pipe up and then it increases the water pressure. Like,
and is that for, let's say the water is attention?
Yeah. Attention, dopamine really is what it is dopamine. Mm. But people with Adderall, and this is a gross simplification, but people with that have ADHD tend to have a very inefficient dopamine system. So their brain just does not get dopamine to the proper areas. So it's kind of like,
I got a lot of realizations from that sentence.
So it's a very leaky pipe. And what Adderall does, like I said, seals it up and then increases the water pressure. Now, increasing the water pressure is what can cause a lot of issues for people. It can cause some manic symptoms. It can cause people to be overly, I mean, a lot of the same symptoms to a subtler degree. People that are amphetamines, you know, coke.
Yeah.
I mean, Adderall is an amphetamine. But that causes a lot of issues for me personally, not just because of the bipolar situation, but even if you remove that, it did increase my blood pressure a lot, even without caffeine. And I'm someone who has kind of naturally high blood pressure. So, and a lot of people that I know do, particularly if you're overweight, it can cause a lot of those issues. And the last thing you want is, you know, heart disease and with that. So for some people, both from a physiological, like heart disease, high blood pressure concern, also kind of the mania, there's so many people that I know that are entrepreneurs that are on Adderall, and they're just, it makes them too externally goal focused.
I recently saw a big thing, how there's an Adderall shortage going on, and there was like this post I saw on LinkedIn where someone was mentioning, like, it was kind of a joke to all the salespeople who need Adderall to do the job. But I realized, like, damn, yeah, a lot of people are heavily relied on Adderall to make them more productive. And it's people who sometimes don't necessarily have ADHD. They're just taking it to, I don't know, increase productivity.
Yeah, and that's the problem is, got some water boiling if you hear in the background. I'm about to start making some tea, and we can get into that in a little bit.
So
we're gonna have a lot of clinking. You're gonna hear a lot of like roaring of the boiling and the
what
tea
is
clinking.
What is the ASMR?
Stuff. Yeah,
gong
yeah.
Fu tea.
Yeah, it's gonna be cool here in a minute. So, yeah. By the way, on time, you want to how long you want to do this?
Dude,
for?
Something I learned from our past episode, listener, if you're starting a podcast, another tip. Number one, get feedback at the end. But number two, Josh really helped me out. I was trying out. I remember very specifically on that particular day, I was trying out what would it be like to film two episodes back to back. And the problem I found is Josh and I's episode was so good that I wanted to keep going, but I had a time crunch. So having meetings after a scheduled episode or anything like that really hinders your ability to just keep going. Long way of saying, I'm good, Josh. I learned my lesson. We can keep talking.
Cool. Until two, so we got a while. So what essentially a lot of the issues I had with Adderall was due to that second part where it's basically an antagonist and like significantly increasing the amount of dopamine in your system. So what's really cool about Suboxone is that it is a dopamine reuptake inhibitor, meaning that it essentially helps your body, it helps your brain basically retain the dopamine and not reuptake, meaning like not losing the dopamine in your system quicker than you can use it. So it's helping you retain the dopamine that you naturally have. Again, gross simplification, but it helps kind of get the point across. So what I like about it is that it doesn't increase your blood pressure, doesn't make you manic, doesn't do all those things. It just kind of helps you focus and helps your body retain the dopamine that you're naturally creating. Now, let's say you're someone like myself who this is great on a daily basis. I take Suboxone every day. One thing to note, and this is kind of my caveat for everything, I buy pretty much everything I possibly can through a company called Nootropics Depot. No affiliation with them, but I'm a massive fanboy of them because the supplement industry is largely unregulated. And it is insane. It's aside from like not being able to put arsenic in it, like you can kind of put whatever the fuck you want in it. Proprietary blends and stuff basically makes it so that you can say that you put things in, but not even like have the amounts in it. It's sketchy. There have been so many studies, like people doing these breakdowns where they'll do third-party testing of all these different supplement companies. And like most of them have significantly less, if any, of what they actually say they have in it. It should be illegal. It is insane. There is a lot of money in the industry from a lobbying perspective to stop that from happening. Nootropics Depot, through many, many years, has earned my trust. The founder is insane. If you go on the Nootropics Depot subreddit, Mr. You Are So Dumb is the owner, and it is insane. Like how transparent the dude is, and like they even did that with a red reishi mushroom extract they came out with recently, where they showed the amount of, you know, standardized, I forget what it is, like reishi something or whatever, wait, I forget what it is, some sort of acid that is like this what they standardize it to, and theirs is like 9%, and like everyone else is like barely like a fraction of a percentage. I mean, it's ridiculous like how small it is. So
I wonder how much they do placebo, like how much are these companies relying on supplements, people being like, all right, well, they think they're gonna get this benefit, let me just put a minimal amount so I can sell it and save money.
A lot, unfortunately. I mean, there are some straight up that Like to give you an example, like with the mushroom situation, and this kind of illustrates how fucked up the industry is. Even some of the biggest brands in the mushroom area, because you know medicinal mushrooms are huge right now: lion's mane, reishi, cordyceps, turkey tail, all that stuff, right? Some of the biggest brands will basically put, they will grow these mushrooms on just like grain and oats and stuff like that, right? And then they will have the mycelium, which is kind of just like the root system, if you will.
Yeah.
It's not the actual fruiting body. It's not the actual mushroom you see. It's just what, you know, goes beneath the surface. They will take the mycelium, because that only takes like 30 days, I think, with reishi mushroom to grow. And then they will grind the mycelium up with the oats or the grain. And then they will put that and encapsulate it and say, okay, that's your reishi mushroom.
Interesting.
That's not all the studies are done on the fruiting body, but the fruiting body takes 9 months to develop. So they don't want to do that. So then they have all these bullshit studies that they pay for that are then done on the mycelium. But even if it was the mycelium, it is almost impossible to separate the mycelium from the grain or whatever substrate that you have. So you're paying a bunch of money for grain and mycelium that doesn't even have like a significant amount of the beneficial stuff in it that the fruiting body has. So like this is part of the problem, is that like even if you're getting, technically it is red reishi mushroom extract that you're getting, but it's bunk. So yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with that. So that's why I love Nootropics Depot. I'm a massive fanboy of them. Again, no financial affiliation, but it is like the only company that I actually trust. Even some like Pure Encapsulations, which was like a really respected brand.
Yeah.
They have now been bought out by Nestle. So I don't fucking trust them at all. So yeah, I mean, so
the guys that try to bottle up water.
Yeah, exactly. So the second thing that I take, I do not take this every day. I actually don't even take this most days anymore. But if it's a day that I really need to focus, it's called L-tyrosine. And you can find this on Nootropics Depot as well. And L-tyrosine is a dopamine precursor. So
dude, that sounds like I've been watching a lot of spaghetti westerns lately. That sounds like a bad guy in a spaghetti western. L-tyrosine.
But yeah, so what's cool about that is it kind of acts like, I was talking about, you know, increasing the water pressure, if you will. It's kind of like a gentle version of that, because it is a precursor to dopamine. So it helps your body, naturally produce, have more ammunition, if you will, to be able to make its own dopamine. So it does help, but it's not like if you're taking Adderall or Vyvanse or Ritalin, where it's pumping it through. So I love this combination. When I talk with people, I mean, because I'm so outspoken about ADHD and all this other stuff, a lot of people come to me and can say, oh, shit, I think I might have ADHD. It's like the conversation we had with Chris on my podcast. I think you said you listened to. My brother actually recently told me that one of his friends listened to that episode and now got diagnosed with ADHD and is getting on medication and stuff. I'm like, that's fucking cool.
I mean, but it's different in adults than it is in kids. That's something that should be noted, said, and it does present itself differently. Like, you can get ADHD when you're older. That's totally plausible.
Well, it just doesn't get diagnosed most of the time, because there is such a thing as like high functioning ADHD, which I was. I was very high functioning, but it still impaired me significantly. Like, there are so many people that I know. A buddy of mine, Mark, like he didn't get diagnosed. I think he's in his like late 30s now. He didn't get diagnosed until like 2 years ago.
Dude, I saw this joke on Reddit that was it was pretty funny. It was like, most of the times, like ADHD or something like that, you get diagnosed by how much of a nuisance you are around others in class. Like, if you are able to handle it and keep it together, you're not going to get diagnosed. But it is. And it's not how much does it impact me and my learning. It's how much are you impacting the learning of those around you.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a bummer.
And that's part of Dr. Gabormate's whole thing, is the myth of normal. And he says we live in a toxic culture. And what he means by that is like, this culture is not optimized for well-being. And particularly when you're a kid, if you're dealing with early childhood trauma, you're easily distractible because you're trying to avoid your present situation, which is very toxic. Like, you come from a family where there's, kind of an absent family member, there's a lot of arguing, there's domestic violence, whatever. you may develop ADHD symptoms to be easily distracted from those circumstances to kind of your UA. And then you go to school, you're easily distracted, you're bored. And then, you know, you become a nuisance that doubles down on you feeling insecure about yourself.
Yeah.
That can develop into an anxiety disorder. There's all these things that are just, it's very multi-layered, but I am very much so a fan of the idea not to kind of pathologize people, but I am definitely a fan of doing early childhood and routine kind of mental health wellness testing for people in going, you know, early childhood, like going through mm-hmm. the school system, because it might actually help unearth some of these things so that they can get proper treatment, whether that be, you know, just therapy or whatever else. But anyway, so these two things are what I recommend for people to start with. There are some people have more severe cases with ADHD, and medication like Ritalin, Adderall, or Vyvanse can be amazing for them. I'm not anti-medication, but I do think that these are more subtle, and also you can just buy them freely.
Yeah.
And the thing about Suboxone, I'm going to talk about these two a little bit more than the other stuff, because I feel like for most entrepreneurs, this is the biggest thing.
And
you know,
one thing I do have a question. So let's say someone listening right now, they're really interested in like the health benefits that supplements have, but they're a bit spooked out on the fact that you said a lot of these companies are kind of like smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
What would you say is the best way to research and trust the brand of supplements you're getting, or to find the right supplements for them?
Yeah, it's a great question. Part of it, I think, goes into, again, like my shorthand is buy from Nootropics Depot. The second is is one of the reasons why I like Nootropics Depot is because if you go on their website, you actually can go and look at their lab. They actually have like an interactive 3D like guided tour of their lab, and then they have videos on it. They show all the lab analysis, their certifications. They show all that stuff on their website, that third-party audits, all this stuff. So you can kind of go on there and quickly be like, okay, these guys are legit, you know?
Yeah.
Most supplement companies don't have any of that stuff on their website. They don't show you their lab. A lot of them don't have labs. What they do is they buy this shit from China. No hate on China, but China is, from a supply chain perspective in the supplement industry, extremely lax with quality control. There are some very ethical high-end labs and sourcing in China, so I'm not blanket statement hating on China, but by volume, by far, most of the stuff coming out of China is very low quality, and a lot of these people are not vetting it. This actually happened recently. I think it was testosterone. There's some sort of supplement that this dude on YouTube, who is like kind of an influencer in the supplement industry, and he basically, the Nootropics Depot actually did a their own lab test on their stuff and was like, this stuff's bullshit. Like, it actually doesn't have most of this stuff in it. It's not good quality. And this guy got really offended. And because people were saying like he was intentionally manipulating people. Ooh. What the end result was is that this guy was basically given a bunch of bunk third party tests that wasn't actually like real. The sourcing of the company that was sourcing all this stuff basically just made up a lab report talking about the purity. And this dude, unbeknownst to him, taking, you know, his professional contacts, taking them at face value, would say, okay, I'm going to come up with this supplement. Mm-hmm. And so if that appears to be the case, I'm trying to be charitable to this guy, that appears to be the case, that stuff happens. So again, it's hard. Like, to answer your question, there is no 100% affirmative way to know, because unfortunately you can't trust the FDA because they don't regulate fucking supplements that much, if at all, outside of like, yeah, you can't put arsenic in your fucking stuff. You know, it can't be something that can kill you, but there's not a lot of oversight in the supplement industry. The other thing, yeah, again, I think I would just look for reviews on Amazon are largely bought. You know, there's a bunch of brands that both Nootropics Depot and other people, like some of our nootropics, our supplements, the people have actually crowdsourced, like paying for third party testing on these supplements. And a lot of these like big brands that you see on there that have lots of reviews are like actually like don't have nearly as much as they say they have in it. Some of them have none, but usually the more popular brands have it, you know, they just might not have as much and it might not be the same quality that they say.
Interesting.
In general, Jarro is pretty good. I like Sports Research. I like Life Extensions. With Thorn is another good one. I used to like Pure Encapsulations, but since they, you know, they got bought out by Nestle, I don't really trust their decision making anymore. Nordic Naturals is pretty good for fish oil. But I, like I said, my default pretty much across the board is Nootropics Depot because they're really the only one I fucking trust. And so, but there's just certain shit that they don't have, you know? So I typically try to go with those brands. There are some, I forget what the company is called, but I get like my chlorella from this one company that's like a German company where they like actually grow it in like glass tubes instead of like in a pond, because the thing with chlorella is it's an algae that absorbs like, it helps you absorb a bunch of toxins and shit. Problem is you put it and you grow it in a giant pond, it absorbs the fucking toxins.
Yeah.
So so like that's a problem, is that you're buying this stuff and it's so good at being a binder for toxins that it again absorbs anything, any impurities.
And then you're putting the toxins in.
Yeah. So they actually grow this shit and clear like huge, long, bendy glass tubes with like distilled water or RO water and stuff like that. And it's like about as pure as you could possibly get. So there are some brands that are like very niche that I generally trust, but that's like on a product by product basis.
Would you start or work with a supplement company?
Maybe potentially working with one soon.
Nice.
But from an ethical standpoint, the problem that I have is I just don't trust most of them. So like I'd have to actually really get to know them and feel like their heart's in the right place.
Yeah,
you know, if Pure Encapsulation is like, hey, we want to work with you, I'm just probably gonna be like, no, because you know, I'd have to really get to know. Like, I haven't worked with one yet, partly out of just not liking most of it, you know. And I would feel weird, even like a dream client of mine would be working with Nootropics Depot, but also it's just like I kind of don't want to taint that because I want people to like actually take me at face value, like. How much of a fucking, like, I really do support
this
brand.
Yeah, I get
brand.
What you mean.
Yeah. So, okay. So that is L-tyrosine and Sobroxy. And I'll send you a list of all these things we talk about. And so you can put it in your show notes for any of your fans that are listening. Longvita, like I said, the curcumin, I take that on a daily basis because for me, I deal with a lot of brain fog and inflammation.
Yeah.
Particularly from stress. So that's,
do you have any
crucial.
Dieting, like any diet restrictions or diets you follow?
Yeah, I have to. Yeah. I was keto for a couple of years and that really helped. And I now know why, because with the autoimmune condition, it's histamines. So there is that is high in histamines that, like,
so you
for
can't
example,
have
spinach.
Wine?
No, I can't have anything fermented anymore. And that's crazy thinking about how much fucking beer and alcohol I used to drink.
That was probably making it so much worse.
Way worse. Yeah. Wow. The problem is that I was otherwise, all the stuff that I was also eating made it worse. So it was hard for me to isolate it. And even when I told you, like, I was doing non-alcoholic, like I was having like O'Doul's and stuff like that, like non-alcoholic beer. And I was like, okay, what's not the alcohol? No, it was the fucking fermented yeast that I was fucking like drinking. So it's like.
That's irony right there.
Yeah. So like for me, it's histamines. There's a lot of things like avocado, really high in histamines. Things that a lot of people think like kombucha, fucking kefir, sauerkraut, kimchi, all things that are, you know, is known for being really good for your microgut biome, right? Problem is super fucking fermented, really high in histamines. Spinach, avocado, beans. Like for a while I was eating really, really clean. So like I'd have like a lot of like basically kind of like Chipotle style bowls with just, you know, rice, vegetables, beans, you know, meat, whatever. And I was eating really, really clean. The problem is most of the stuff I was eating, even though it was really clean, super high in histamines. So for me personally, that was a problem. And there's kind of a thing called like the histamine bucket where most people never go over that threshold. Because they don't have an accumulation of histamines. But let's say, for example, you're someone who has a lot of allergies. Well, your body's pumping a lot. You know, that's why people take antihistamines, you know, like Claritin and stuff like that. They take that to help reduce the amount of histamines from an allergic response.
Yeah.
Well, if you are, if you are now eating this stuff, like let's say you already, your baseline, you have an allergy and your baseline histamines is really, really high. Well, then you're eating all this food that's high in histamines. It's kind of like putting you over the threshold.
Yeah.
And you start having a lot of really bad symptoms. Most people don't get to that point. But for me, because my baseline was so high, now I'm on a bunch of immunosuppressants and a lot of things like low dose naltrexone. I'm on like ketotifen and a lot of things that help either reduce inflammation and also reduce histamine production. So I have some leeway. As long as I'm pretty good, I can generally go like 3-4 days kind of eating a normal diet. If I get stressed or I really start going off my diet hardcore, that engine kind of starts to rev back up. And then once I go over the threshold, it takes me like 2 weeks to get back to baseline. So I really have to watch myself. Like when I went to Vietnam, I kind of just decided like, I'm just going to eat whatever the fuck I want. And like, I'm going to feel like shit when I get back, but I don't care because I want to eat whatever I want.
Yeah.
But I did that with intention, and man, I came back, I paid for it so bad. Like I just felt like shit. I could like barely do anything for 2 weeks. It sucked. But so yeah, I have a pretty limited diet, but it's not nearly as limited as it was like a year or so ago. So my treatment with the Cleveland Clinic's helped a lot.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
How about your
other stuff I take? Go on.
I was going to say, I was getting curious about your tea diet. We've been teasing this for a while, for two episodes now.
Yeah. So I got this for people that are watching on the video. I've got my whole kind of like set up here. So what this is you've got a tea table. And for people that are just listening to audio, it's basically like a table that has kind of like a top with a bunch of slats in it. So you can pour, as you're pouring the tea and everything, water will go through those slats and into the kind of like container below it. So it's
really
kind of like just, yeah, it's really cool. And the reason why is because you've got this thing called a gaiwan, which has got your little saucer and it's got a little cup with a lid. And you take that and you basically pour it into this little pitcher with a strainer. And it's a very small amount of, very, very small amount of tea at a time. And this is called gung fu style making tea. And really this cup that I have, which is the cup that you drink out of, really is enough for like one big kind of gulp or like maybe two sips or something like
that.
It's a small amount. And the reason why is because you are, and this is one of the reasons why I love it as a practice, almost as like a meditation practice, is that it helps you slow the fuck down. There's this guy named Daniel. He's a Chinese man, and he has a place called the Tea Shop in Vancouver, BC, in Canada. I highly recommend if you go to Vancouver, check out the Tea Shop. Even if you don't care about tea, it's a pretty cool place, and he's super knowledgeable. And when I was there, he was talking about how he's like, most people drink tea, it's like McDonald's. Like you go there, you get, you know, kind of bad tea leaf. You usually use too hot of water. It's bitter. It doesn't taste very good. And then you have it in a giant cup. You're just sitting there. You're just kind of mindlessly drinking it. Like, it's like a beverage. He's like, that's like the McDonald's.
Me this entire episode, taking my gulps of tea.
Yeah. So.
Green tea.
But see, that's the thing. It's like, he's not hating on it, but he's just like, that's kind of what it is. And he's like, well, basically, what this is you're putting in this little gaiwan, which is like a little, like I said, like a little cup with a little lid on it. You are filling it up about halfway with tea leaf. And then you're pouring small amounts of water. The first thing you do is you put the tea leaf. The first thing that I do is I do a rinse, which I have hot water. And then I kind of put some in the gaiwan and then I pour it into the pitcher and then I pour it into the cup. And what that does is get rid of any dust, but also what it's doing is warming the vessels. Because if you just put water in it, you lose heat immediately because that heat transfers into the containers, right, to warm those up. So you lose heat. So you want to like heat it up first so that it doesn't lose any heat when you pour it in for the actual thing. The second thing that I do is I put the tea leaves in there and then I will do a kind of a rinse where I'll just kind of, you know, top it up and I'll let it sit for like maybe 1 or 2 seconds and then I'll just rinse it. And that gets, again, because the tea is aged and, you know, you might be dust or fragments or whatever. We just want to get rid of all that shit so you're not drinking it. And then after that, it really depends on the tea, but then you will pour water in it and you will let it sit from either anywhere from a minute, a second or two, depending on like what kind of tea it is, up to like 10 seconds. And then you will pour it into the, you know, through the strainer. People watching, you got like the little pitcher and you got the little strainer, and you pour it through the strainer, goes into the little pitcher. And again, the pitcher is about enough for maybe two cup fills, you know, small little yeah. cup fills. And the kind of philosophy of this is that you are making small little batches of tea. And what happens is that if you're using the higher quality, like loose leaf tea, you can get anywhere from, if we consider one of these kind of batches that I just said, like an infusion or in a steeping, you can get anywhere from like 3 to 30 steepings out of these teas. Yeah, if you get like a pu'er, which is what I have right here and what I'm drinking, and this is they kind of call it like a tea cake. It's like a giant, it's like a giant kind of block of tea that's highly compressed. This is super, super compressed. And if I were to actually like uncompress this, it would be a massive amount of tea leaf, but it's super compressed. And what you do is you take off a little bit of this at a time, and you kind of naturally age this tea. So I have pu'er tea from the 1970s that I got from Daniel in Vancouver. Daniel's kind of one of those guys where like I trust him. There's a lot of fake tea, just like there's a lot of fake supplements in the tea industry. Again, China supply chain, a lot of things. Pu'er is one of those things that this is a big issue with wine as well. Wine really kind of exploded in the late 80s and 90s. And basically, because of that, there was like this explosion of interest in old aged wines, but there wasn't enough supply for the demand, so people started faking it. Same thing with pu'er tea. A lot of this tea is aged, and because the demand like exploded in the early 2000s, there's a lot of fake aged pu'er. But I generally trust Daniel in sourcing. But I've got, you know, tea from the 70s, the 80s, early 90s, and it's really interesting to see how it changes. And even some of the pu'er kit that I bought like 5-10 years ago, I will kind of have it a couple times a year, and I'll just kind of see how it changes. And some of these I hope to have for another decade or so, you know, and just kind of cycle them in and cycle them out.
Try this, because really cool. I'm a big tea fan. That's what I prefer over coffee. And that is fast. I saw that for the listener that isn't on video. The compressed cake is like a small to medium sized plate, but kind of dense looking, just block of tea, and it's impressive.
Yeah, on the video right now, I'm kind of showing like you can see the side that it's like, you know, normal how you get it.
Yeah.
But then I've been chipping off.
I can see where you're, you're like
chipping off
it.
Little pieces. Yeah. And so it's really cool. So anyway, why this is so cool is for two reasons. One, the end result, and two, the process. So the end result is if you're just drinking like Lipton tea, you know, again, I'm not trying to hate on whatever. I hate people that, I am annoyed by people that are like gatekeepers, shit like that. Like I occasionally, like I've got, sometimes I'll use like a little coffee maker and just throw like a little tea bag of fucking like peppermint tea in there and just like, you know, do whatever. Like I am not a, you know, crazy, you know, snob about it. However, you know, if you're drinking tea this way, you have to have a pretty decent quality tea leaf, because otherwise like it loses flavor really fast, right? It doesn't mean it has to be expensive. That's actually something a lot of people don't get, is that when you're getting a tea like this and you consider how many times you're re-steeping it and you don't have to use new tea bags or new tea, it actually is pretty fucking cheap for the quality of what you're getting. People really, they look at tea and they're like, oh my God, like, a 8 ounces of this is like $30. And it's like, yeah, but it doesn't have to be that expensive, but that actually is going to give you a lot of tea. Like you can just use one set of tea leaves for the entire day, you know, rather than having to use like 4 or 5 tea bags. So it's not that bad. But so there's kind of an end result where you will then, that first steeping you're going to do is going to have a lot of really intense flavors, because that's kind of like the high end, you know, it's like the most obvious. But then as you start to do more steepings, the flavor changes. You start having these little subtleties that got masked by like the really strong flavors. And it actually starts to change. And it can become.
My laptop is at 1%. Hang on a second.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, go get your charger, man. All righty. Well, we're back. I had to take a little technical break, and I also had
Tech
to fill
break.
Up. Yeah, I had to get some more hot water for my tea so we could continue steeping this conversation. Jesus Christ. That was bad, even by my dad joke standards. No, I just pulled that out of the ether, but yeah, that was pretty bad. I'm just embracing, all my friends call me dad, as I'm just like evolving into my like fucking dad phase of my life where I'm just like making these stupid jokes and crap and whatever, but I just embraced it at this point. I fought it for a while. Now I'm just like, all right, yeah, okay, I'm dad. This is happening. The transition has occurred. But yeah, man. So like the cool thing about this is kind of two. One, like you're having multiple steepings and every single time the flavor changes. Everything kind of changes. And what happens is that, like I said, with this one, it's a Xing Pu'er, meaning it's kind of a greenish aged tea. It's fairly light. It's a little spicy almost. Has kind of a earthy kind of flavor. That's one of the things I like about Pu'er teas is they're really kind of complex.
Yeah.
So there's a lot there. Like I've done this. I love introducing people to this way of tea that have never had tea like this before, because I've had friends that don't even give a shit about tea. They're coffee people, or they just don't care about tea. And I'll show them this process and they'll taste it and they'll be like, oh shit. Like after the third or fourth steeping, they're like, wow, okay, I actually do taste a difference. That's interesting. And they start to get intrigued by it. It's just a really interesting process. So yeah, like with this one, I might steep it for me personally, I might steep it like 3 seconds because I want it to be kind of light and I want to get kind of the characteristics. But then, you know, the next one I might do like 6-7 seconds. The next one I might do like 15 seconds. And then you start to, you know, increase the time.
Oh.
Where I might, by the end, like I'm at like steeping 25 or whatever, like I might let it sit for like 2-3 minutes and just, you know, whatever. Because how it works is tannins. So like there's certain tannins, like that's what actually makes tea dark. Same thing with coffee. You know, it's tannins leach. Part of the thing that like why people say they don't like green tea, for example, is most of the time, and again, I'm not trying to be a fucking snob about it, but they're not making it properly. And the reason why is because, and this, I actually blame some of the fucking tea companies, because on the box, it actually says use boiling water. It's steep for 3 minutes. That's terrible for most green teas, particularly green teas in a tea bag, because what the tea bag tea is generally is like the dust that settles, like it gets shifted like from the higher quality leaf. And that's not like a you know, jerk off equality thing. The smaller the leaf, meaning it, the more surface area there is. So if you have a full leaf, like a literal full leaf, and you steep it, it doesn't have as much surface area that is open for tannins to get out. So it's more of a slow release. If you've got dust, basically, where it's like got a billion openings to it, tannins can leach out very fast. And what happens is if you're using boiling water and then you're steeping it for 2-3 minutes, too many tannins are coming out too quickly, and that's where you get that kind of bitter, you know, grassy bitter taste that people don't like. So if you use, like, you know, let's say you boil water and you let it sit for like 2 minutes and then you steep it for like a minute, try that. If you have like green tea or something, try it. At black tea, you do want to do boiling. You do want to have it like about 212, but green tea is usually like 180. So, you know, you let it sit for 2 minutes and the flavor is very different. And so that's kind of a cool way. But so the flavor changes. But really, at the end of the day, why I like it the most is because it's kind of just like a meditative process. I will sit here. I have my kettle. I will pour it into the little Gaiwan pitcher, or sorry, the little Gaiwan, and then I will pour that into the pitcher. And then that has, like, you know, it's done. I can pour it into my cup as much, you know, as quickly or as slowly as I want. I will sit there. And if you're on video, I've got this little cup. I take a sip, and again, there's probably like 2 or 3 sips in this little cup. And that causes me to pause. And then I'll kind of go back to my work at my desk. And then I'll take another sip, and then my cup's empty. So then I will pause what I'm doing. I'll go over and I'll, you know, pour the pitcher, pour the water in, into the cup. And I'm taking a second And I'm, you know, now taking a sip. And it's these little tiny micro breaks that kind of just, they kind of just slow you down. And it's very kind of meditative. Whereas, like, you know, you're kind of mindlessly sitting there just chugging like an energy drink or something like that. It's not causing you to slow down. And again, like, I'm not hating on any other way of doing things. It's just, for me, I find this very relaxing, and it causes me to kind of slow down and be a lot more present. So I really like it. There's a tremendous of different types of tea. Like, I have yet to not be able to find a tea that somebody likes. You know, there's just so many different types of tea and different characteristics. There's even smoky tea, Lapsang Sichuan, which is black tea that they actually historically put over big pine wood baskets. Or sorry, the big wicker baskets, and they will actually put it in there and roast it over pine wood fires. And it kind of has this, like, it basically makes your room smell and taste like a campfire, which I know some people are horrified by that thought. Other people really like it. I like it. A couple of my friends really like it. It's very nostalgic. Some people hate it. But, you know, there's just all these kind of weird teas that you can try that are really interesting. If you're wanting to get a good entry point, is a company called Adagio. It's just adagio.com. And
I was going to say, where do you find the starting kit?
Yeah, they're really, I like Adagio because it's good quality. It's but it's really user friendly, and they have a lot of flavored teas. They have a lot of starter sets. It's they've got some really cool tea makers that you can use, which is kind of like a giant clear one that you put the tea in and you pour it in, and then actually once it's done steeping, you actually put it on top of your cup and it like pours down. There's some really cool things they have. It's a very, newbie-friendly kind of brand. Like, you could keep buying their tea for forever, and it's not bad quality. It's really good. But if you want to go even nerdier, there's, like, some more, you know. But I like Adagio as far as a good entry point. They're great. The next kind of level, there's a company called Teavivre, like T-E-A-V-I-V-R-E, something like that. I like them. Yunnan Sourcing is another one I really, really like. Verdant tea is probably the one I would recommend most to people. I really like Verdant tea. Actually, that's what I'm drinking right now. That the tea cake was, the pu'er was from them. This is kind of like what some of their packaging looks like if you're on video. The reason I really like Verdant tea, V-E-R-D-A-N-T, is because they are based out of Minneapolis, I believe, but all they have these relationships with small farmers. So it's like all like a co-op, farmers that have been like, you know, 5-6 generations tea makers, you know, and like they don't use any pesticides, you know, it's all natural, small batch stuff. For the quality you get, it's pretty affordable, but I like the tea industry has as the coffee industry does too, has a lot of really bad, like, you know, labor issues, people getting, you know, either screwed monetarily or really bad working conditions. I really like supporting Verdanti and some of these other companies that work with small independent farmers. It's just a lot more ethical. And also, I don't have to worry as much about drinking fucking pesticide water and shit like that. So, you know, with coffee, at least, you know, you've got the outer fruit kind of around the coffee bean and they take that off. Tea, if they're spraying with pesticides, you're drinking the fucking shit, you know? So that's a concern of mine. So I really like ones like that. There's also Two Dog. It's called White 2T, like White number 2T. And this guy runs it called Two Dog. And it's awesome. He all of his, like, the rappers for all of his stuff is like fucking hip hop references and memes and stuff. So he's just like this. Yeah. I love him. Really good quality tea, but like he's just like a millennial dude that just like has fun, you know, with it. Like he lives, I think, in Yunnan, like in the mountains and stuff. It's his Snapchats are crazy. Like, it's just him like on his little bike going up to one of the tea farms. He's just blasting like Run the Jewels or Biggie or something. Like, it's awesome. So, you know, a lot of really great tea suppliers, and I don't know. I love it. I find myself drinking a lot of like just black coffee these days, which is interesting because there's a coffee shop that I go to. But if I'm home, most of the time I'm making tea, and it's just really chill. So, are there any tea questions you got?
Yeah, what's your favorite flavor?
Oh man, it varies a lot. I really like green teas. I'm not like as partial to these days. I like some oolongs, and even within oolongs, there's a wide spectrum. So you have like green oolongs, which can be kind of grassy or even like kind of thick and buttery almost. It's really interesting. Then you've got like darker oolongs that are darker roasted, kind of like a coffee, you have a real different roasting. And then you've got like black oolongs, which are like up in the Wuyi Mountains. And what's really cool about those is that the Wuyi Mountains is very high in mineral content. Like it's up in the rocks, like rocky mountainous area. So it has this kind of like dark, earthy mineral flavor just from the composition of the soil. And then they like roast it over a fire. So it's like got this like kind of charcoaly in a good way, like dark, minerally, kind of like apricotty kind of flavor a lot of the time. Really interesting. There's some black teas I really like. Like there's some black teas that are like naturally almost chocolatey, which is really interesting. Yeah, it's really
I've
interesting.
never experienced that, but
Yeah, I can send you some links to some of that stuff. Like there's actually some black teas, the way they're processed, they're actually yellow. Like the leaf tips are actually like bright yellow and they're kind of malty. It's really interesting. My favorite
I gotta get
these
my tea
days,
game up. That's the biggest thing I'm picking up from here. I knew
dude.
the I use a kettle for my green tea, and it's definitely like I keep it to 180, 190.
Yeah.
So I knew that trick, but everything else, man. I'm so
Yeah.
curious.
The pu'er is my favorite. It's the aged tea, and there's kind of two different types of pu'er. There is shu and there is sheng. Shu means aged or dark. Sheng, which is what I'm drinking, you probably saw the leaves were kind of like dark greenish, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas shu is like dark brown or black. So again, sheng means young or green or light, you know, fresh. And what's interesting about that is like they basically take the leaves, they compress them into that, and then they just kind of they might process it minerally, but minimally, but then they just kind of let it age as is. The shu, they usually are artificially, they're put in like these wet rooms, they'll like artificially kind of age them, and they're darker, and they're it's more like a black tea. But the thing I like about both of them is there's just so much more variety. Because of the aging process, it takes on a lot of characteristics of whatever atmosphere it's in. So if you and I bought the same, like, you know, raw Xing pu'er tea, like, and let's say it was from you know, it was from this year, you know, it got picked and processed this year.
Yeah.
You and I had it, you know, you're in one area of the country that's got, you know, higher moisture or, you know, whatever different temperature, and I'm in a colder area that's not as moist and whatever. After 5 years, they're actually going to taste differently. You know,
That
they'll be in
is.
the same general ballpark, but they'll
Yeah.
actually taste differently just from the moisture, temperature, and all these other environmental factors. It's really cool, you know?
It's almost like I don't even have I'm the word that comes to mind is like collector's item, or like I can't think of the word for what it would be like an unlike wine tasting collector, something like that. But the fact that over the time that you hold this tea and like have it will adapt to your environment and change taste. That's so cool.
Yeah. That's one of the things I love about it. And the thing is like, there's so
You'd be
many
trading with
variables.
friends like, oh, you got that Denver from 07? I got some San Diego 03 if you want to try it out.
No, for real. Yeah. I have done tea swaps before. I have routinely like sent people little care packages and stuff, or if I have friends from out of town come, like I'll kind of make them a little care package of different types of teas and stuff like that. There was a, they still do them, I'm sure, online, like tea swaps and stuff like that, like on RT and
Yeah.
some of these other like communities on Reddit. Like
Let me
people will
check that
do
out.
tea swaps and they'll just like, you know, send each other stuff. Generally, they'll be like, hey, you know, some people have, you know, relatively limited kinds of tea. Some people have fucking giant collections, like huge, and they'll be like, what kind of tea do you like? And they'll kind of put together a little care package. I had somebody who do that for me once. They sent me some really weird, obscure shit, and then they actually made their own teaware. They did pottery, and I got this really cool cup this guy made. It's really interesting. So I met some really cool people on the tea community. I'm not nearly into all that as I used to be.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty casual with these days. Like, I'll just kind of buy some tea and I'll drink it. And I'm not really that involved in the community or any sense of stuff anymore. But I plan on opening a tea lounge here locally probably in the next like 5 years. So I'll probably get more back into the community and all that stuff when I do it. Because there's just no... In the United States, I would say there's literally only a handful of like legit tea lounges. Like, there's tea shops, but an actual tea lounge. The Dobra Tea, they're actually a small, like, quasi-chain, more like a franchise where it varies even between them. But there's, like, two in Asheville, North Carolina. There's one in Pittsburgh. I think there's, like, one in Maine, one in Boston or something. There's only a handful of them. But they really do it right. I actually, I've spent a lot of time in the one in Asheville, and then I was just in Pittsburgh a couple weeks ago for about a week, and I went there several times. And it's just a cool spot. You just sit there.
Would you open one of their franchises, or would you do your own?
I've considered it, but I think me just being as, I don't know, independent as I am, I'd want to just do everything on my own.
Yeah.
Like, so I've considered, they do consulting. I've considered maybe hiring them from a consulting and just be like best practices and whatever. I don't know. I'll see. It's not something that's on my radar for at least in a couple more years. They've just got too much stuff going on. But somewhere in the next like 5, 10, probably closer to 5 than 10, I want to open a tea lounge, do it proper here. I know so many people that own restaurants and bars and stuff around here. Well, it won't be hard to kind of piece it all together, but it's just, I need to be in a place where I feel like I have the time and the bandwidth, and also like with my health, like I need, hopefully with a Cleveland Clinic, you know, in the next couple of years, I might have to be on treatment for another year or two. We'll see. So until then, I'm really trying to limit what I take on.
Yeah, probably wise.
So, yeah. But anything else you want to dive into, man?
Nah, dude. I just want time for the closing questions. I've already asked you this bit, but I have a feeling some of them have changed.
Yeah, go for
just
it.
Just because, yeah. But first of all, I did want to say thank you very much for coming on again, dude. The audio problems are a bit unfortunate, but we made it work, man. Yeah. Like, it's all good. Yeah. What kind of music or podcasts have you been listening to lately?
Good question. I mean, music, really these days, I'm listening to a lot. I'm just going to get my Spotify open and kind of see, but I listen to a lot of like Boards of Canada, Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross soundtracks. I listen to a lot of his like Akira Yamamoka's like Silent Hill soundtracks. I listen to a lot of like kind of soundtracks as like background music. I don't listen to a hell of a lot of music with lyrics these days, which is really interesting. You know, if I do listen to stuff, like I've got, just kind of going here through my stuff. I've really, really like, go ahead.
One soundtrack, and it's going to tie into the next question of what movies or shows have you watched recently? This is the one that I've been wanting to ask you, is I know you expressed being a Batman fan in the past. Did you see the newest Batman, and what did you think? Dude, sometimes I listen to that soundtrack. That was another side note that I was going to say for the soundtrack thing. Really good. Yeah, really good. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, something in the way. that was just like, something in the way. Yeah, like that was like in my fucking like the back of my head for like 3 weeks after, and I thought it was just me, and then all my friends are like, yeah, no, same, fucking Nirvana, like just but yeah, I absolutely love the new Batman. It's to me, it Darren Aronofsky was actually supposed to do like a Batman Year One before Christopher Nolan did Batman Begins. I always wanted to see what that was going to be like, because it sounded so much darker, bleaker, like Selina Kyle, Catwoman, was going to be like a prostitute, like a dominatrix. And it was supposed to be like really dark. And I always wanted to see what that kind of much more abrasive and existentially bleak Batman would look like. And I've always kind of wanted to see, like, I've always seen like Bruce Wayne as a very broken person. That was one of the things that I didn't necessarily like about the Christian Bale Batmans, is like, I appreciate them and I really do like them. You know, if they're not extremely uneven, Like it is cohesively jarring. Like it is extremely tonally jarring, I should say, the difference between Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, and Rises. Like they look like they feel like they were done by completely different filmmakers. I mean, the Batman Begins is much darker, bleaker, comic booky, and then Batman The Dark Knight is just like this kind of, I don't even know. Like it feels much more grounded in reality. Like it doesn't, you know, it's just Chicago. Like it doesn't feel like Gotham, you know, like it's just odd. So this new movie I really liked because to me it seemed like they kind of took the Arkham City games and the Batman animated series and a lot of the kind of comic books, like him being a detective, and they really just made it. They perfectly kind of took the benefits of the animated series, but translated it into film.
Yeah,
you know, and it worked. Like it was both simultaneously kind of more cartoony and comic-y than the Nolan films, but also like grittier and somehow seemed more realistic in a way. It's very interesting. I don't know. I really appreciated it.
It felt a lot more like a detective or like mystery yeah. movie than anything else, which is something I really liked. And I think I really like this fun fact, how the screenwriters just listened to like Nirvana on repeat while they were like writing the movie and the music so that they could get a feeling for the tone they were going for. It was like that yeah. era of grunge rock. They would just have it in the writing room. That was really cool. But yeah, dude, I was a big fan.
Yeah. That's what, what's his name? Oh God. Writer of Fight Club. Not Palahniuk. I forget his name. This is going to bother me now. The Fight Club, right? He's just listening to the Downward Spiral by Nine Inch Nails, like, nonstop. Yeah, Chuck Palahniuk, yeah. Like, Chuck Palahniuk, when he was doing Fight Club, when he was writing the novel Fight Club, like, he just listened to the Downward Spiral of Nine Inch Nails, like, on repeat. And, like, so it's just, I love when people have that. They kind of take that tonal
yeah.
soundscape and apply it. But, yeah, I mean, other than that, as far as like music, I've been listening to a lot of Mark Lanegan. He died recently and that really bummed me the fuck out. But, you know, so I've been listening to a lot of stuff. As far as film and all that, I watched like the first season of Better Call Saul and then just completely dropped off. Not because I didn't like it, but I just stuff happened. I just got out of the habit of watching it. And then I recently kind of, I had another one of those flare-ups with the autoimmune condition. I just really couldn't work much.
Yeah.
I could only really do the bare minimum. So, you know, everything in me was just like work, work, work. But, you know, like my partners being like, no, dude, you need to like take time off and relax. And like my friends are being like, yeah, just fucking relax. So like as kind of therapy, I just like binged watch during the evenings for like a week or two, just like Better Call Saul. Just watch the rest of the four seasons or whatever. And I don't do shit like that. Like, I don't just, like, watch shows. I don't just sit down and do any stuff. I don't watch a lot of movies these days. But I've been trying to get better. I've been trying to take more time off and just kind of relax. So I watched all that. I don't know if I like it more in Breaking Bad. I've heard a lot of people say that they liked it more. I think there's parts of it that I like. But it's also been a long time since I watched Breaking Bad. So I would have to see. But there's something about the last handful of episodes of Breaking Bad that are so existentially bleak that just call me, that I love, like Ozymandias in the very last episode where Walt is essentially like the spoilers, I guess, but I mean, come on, it's been out for forever at this point. But you know, he's just like the Walking Dead, like he's not even alive anymore. He's just
yeah.
And I just love that. Like there's just something so bleak about it, and I think that's like the reoccurring theme for me. Like the bleaker something is, the more I like it. A movie recommendation that I made before on my show, but I highly recommend, is Aniara, Aniaria, something like that. And it's a Swedish film. And if you've watched the film Don't Look Up, it's kind of a good like counterpart to that.
Yeah.
And what I like about Don't Look Up is it's basically like, hey, you know, if we're all gonna, you know, die and like, you know, world ending thing, what happens? NER is kind of just like, what happens if like humanity could somehow survive? Like the planet was going to die, but like we were going to like get people to Mars and stuff. Like, what would that be like? What would the actual reality be? And it's bleak. It has actually completely changed my perspective on, I guess, like our species surviving outside of the context of being on the planet. It's really interesting. So, yeah, if you like dark and bleak stuff, NER is definitely like on my top recently that I've watched.
Dude, one thing I really like to bring it back to the Breaking Bad thing is I grew up watching Malcolm in the Middle, and to see the goofy dad be Bryan Cranston go into the Heisenberg role was fantastic, dude. You just see like his ability to act shine in that.
Yeah, he's an amazing actor. I was kind of hoping he would do more stuff. Like, seems like same thing with Aaron Paul. Like, they've been in things before, but he hasn't been in anything that I've been aware of that's really pushed his range. I was kind of hoping both of them would do more, I don't know, something of the caliber of that. And maybe they have, and I'm just not aware of it, but I haven't seen anything.
Yeah, that's a good point. What about any books? What kind of books are you reading?
The Myth of Normal, like I was talking
about.
Myth of
Normal, dude. I'm going to check that out, definitely. That sounds very fascinating.
Yeah, I've been, let me get my Audible up. It's one of those things where, like, you put me on the spot and I'm just like, but yeah, The Myth of Normal is definitely up there. The one that I've been kind of revisiting lately is The Body Keeps the Score, which is also kind of in line. Yeah, it's kind of in line with that. I think most of my, what is the other one? Tara Brach. Already Free is another one that I've been kind of getting into again. I think overall, like I've really been kind of trying to lean heavily into being kind of at peace with just day-to-day life, not so much like optimizing like efficiency and more so just being okay with like what is. And I've been spending a lot of time the last year in particular kind of unpacking a lot of my own neurotic tendencies and how I can just be more kinder to myself and more at peace and be okay with less. And even like the projects that I'm taking on, like being like not needing to like scale everything and taking on these grandiose things, just being more okay with just content in general. And I think that's like unsexy, you know. That's not like the thing that most people like optimize for.
Dude, it resonates with me so much in this point in time. Mm-hmm. Just because I very, very recently had this revelation of like, I've been trying so hard to the point where it's been honestly kind of hurting me to be super productive, over optimize everything, make sure everything I do is the best. Like anything I do has to be, and we kind of talked about this on the last episode, but like the problem still happens. And then the revelation I kind of experienced was everything I'm doing is pretty great. I'm having a great time. Things are going very well for me. The thing that I am not okay with, and it's something I simply can't change, is that I want everything to happen to me tomorrow. And it takes patience. It takes time. So enjoying the ride is enjoying each day, because that's all we really get is the little moments we have throughout our day. So I totally agree, dude. It's letting go of I have to be outputting 100% every single day. It's letting go of that. And a lot of what I've realized is, dude, especially having this podcast, doing it on habits and hobbies and trying to see like what makes people productive. The thing that keeps showing up time and time again is not trying so hard to be productive. That's it.
Sam Harris has a line. If anyone's interested in getting into meditation, really, I highly recommend Sam Harris's app called Waking Up. And if you've tried meditation before and you're like, this is some woo-woo bullshit, it doesn't apply to me, blah, 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 or it's, you know, this new age, whatever. I highly, highly recommend just trying the Waking Up app. I think it's free for the first like 10 days or something like that. Because meditation has helped me significantly. And it's helped ground me, and it's made me a better entrepreneur, and it's made me a better person, and it's made me a lot more centered. But he has this, he has this line where he's like, what is the cash value of living a better life every single day for the rest of your life? Like, if you could put a cash value on your life being 20% better, you know, like 20% less stressed, 20% less hard on yourself, 20% more clear-minded so you can make better decisions. If you had to pay for that, like, what would that be worth to you? Like, a lot of fucking money. And then you have the compound interest of, you know, let's say you're going to be alive another 40, 50 years, 50 years of like enjoying your life and being freer and making better decisions, both like for your health and your business and your well-being and your family. And it's just like, I think that's what I'm looking at now is like, how can I, you know, how can I improve that my day-to-day well-being? Because that's going to compound over time. You know, a book I'd really recommend if you haven't picked it up, and it's probably like the book I'd recommend to almost everybody, although Myth of Normal, I'm like 75% through, and it's starting to go up there for me.
Yeah.
But Awareness by Anthony DeMello is huge. And he, it's like the closest that I've seen to someone just like waking you up from the matrix in a way, and kind of just like seeing reality for what it really is, because he really kind of illustrates in that book. I'll really recommend getting the Audible version if you can, because what it is actually his lectures from like the 80s. And the book is basically just a distilled down kind of version of his lectures that he did. But I really like him as a person. His speaking is very unique. He was a Jesuit priest, so he just has this really interesting, it's not religious. He actually, the Catholic Church actually like has disclaimers on his books, even though he's really popular, about like, hey, not everything he says actually aligns with the Catholic Church, because he called out religion a lot. Like, he was a Jesuit priest. He believed in, you know, God and all that stuff, but he called out religion, you know, capital R religion, like a lot, which I'm not a religious person. And I found it really interesting how he kind of like cut through the bullshit. But he kind of really illustrates just like how much our conditioning affects our worldview, like society's conditioning and whatever. And it's like, I think he's the more philosophical, whereas like Gabor Mate is saying very similar things, but it's more grounded in kind of like science, reality, whatever. So it's really, I think they're good parallels. But yeah, Awareness by Anthony DeMello, really, really recommend.
Nice.
And I hate the fucking like, we have a natural good, talking about podcast adequately, we have a really nice, natural, like good grounding point here, but there is something that I forgot to say that I really want to on the supplement front is, if you're somebody who deals with anxiety, like I have, there is a neuropeptide. It's, you can get it as a nasal spray called Celanc, Selank, and it has significantly helped me with my anxiety. So if you're someone who deals, if you're an entrepreneur or just someone who's anxious and deals with anxiety, there are things. It's been shown to be, I'm not a doctor, but there's been a bunch of studies that have shown this to be just as effective as benzos, but without any of the addictive properties. So I'm saying this because like I have had a lot of friends try it and be like, holy shit, this has been a game changer for me. So I try to talk about it as much as I can, because anxiety has been probably the largest stressor of my life, literally. Wow. And it has really helped me a lot. So I think that if that might be a good kind of thing to look into if you're someone that deals with a lot of anxiety. But
I think it's important that you're bringing awareness to like all possible solutions. I've always a big thing I say in this podcast, going towards what I say is for morning routines, but it applies to pretty much anything in life, is to figure out what works for you. Try everything in a healthy manner, but like try as many different things as possible. If you feel as though, you know, taking things like Xanax works, then good. That's good. If you feel like that's not really the solution for you, yet it's the only one that's kept being, you know, presented to you. It's definitely important to try as many different things as possible.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, really the thing that's helped me the most that we didn't get into also is sauna. I get in the sauna probably one to three times a day most of the time.
Damn, dude.
I get it a
little jealous. I was listening to the Rick Rubin episode of Joe Rogan, and he mentions how one of the things that he does in his day is he'll go ice bath, sauna, like four times in a row and tries to push it. Like, he'll spend up to like, I think he said his most is like 30 minutes in the ice bath, which is gnarly, dude. Absolutely gnarly. And then he'll just go sauna after.
I do cold showers. I do cold showers most days, and it helps, particularly after a sauna. Getting in the sauna has helped me more than anything, along with meditation. But I think they go hand in hand, because there's times when I am so stressed out, it is really hard for me to even like get myself grounded enough to even meditate properly. So I'll go in the sauna and, you know, usually do about 30 minutes until I can't take it anymore, and then I'll do a cold shower, and then that takes my baseline down like to a manageable degree where then I can meditate and really be present. So you know, as far as the sauna, you can get on Amazon for like $100 like these kind of steam saunas, and they come with like kind of like a big kind of like tent, and then it'll actually almost like a humidifier, pump hot air into it, like steam, you know. It's just basically just an industrial humidifier. And the only problem with that is I had to actually have two of those rigs, and I had to like kind of hack it and have two of them going into the tent at once to get it to how hot I wanted it to be, but I'm crazy. And I ended up upgrading to a thing called the Relax Sauna, which is the only type of sauna that actually has like FDA approval, and it actually like gets your core body temperature enough to be the same as like the Swedish sauna studies. I wouldn't get any infrared saunas on Amazon that are like, you know, the $200, $300, $500 ones, because they're not effective enough. From everything that I've seen, like a bunch of people have done a bunch of tests online and they don't raise core body temperature that much.
Yeah. So same goes for trusting your supplements, trust like all, like look into what you're going to buy. If it's a health related purchase, most purchases, but like with anything you're doing, putting into your body, doing to your body, definitely do the time and research, because that shit could have permanent negative effects.
For sure. And then the thing that I like about the Relax sauna is that I get, you know, they're not cheap. It's like $1,400. But for me, the ROI is insane, because like compared, it is the only thing that has been comparable to like an actual full size, like real sauna that you would get, you know, find at like a fucking a high quality gym or something like that. Like, I get in it and within like 5 minutes, like I'm sweating like a lot. I've tried like four other types of saunas that you have at the house, and like they just don't, even like the big like $2,500 like infrared saunas that you know can get like a kit at like Costco or something like that. I've been in one of those and they're not as effective as this thing. So it's one of those things where like $1,400 might be a lot for you or might not be a lot depending on, you know, where you're at in your life. But to me, if you can afford it, I wish I would have got it sooner. I was kind of like seeing, okay, well, maybe I could do this, maybe I could do that. And I held off, and I kind of wish I would have just got it sooner, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Like, part of the reason I held off is because like, oh, I'm going to buy a house, I'm going to build out a proper one and all this stuff. And it's just like, I don't really even need to do all that now, because this thing's so effective. Like having a full sauna and it just seems like a pain in the ass at this point in my life. But, but yeah, I like it. It does well. Really helps me a lot, but yeah, man, this has been fun. It's been fun. Yeah, dude.
Last one. Where can people find you?
JoshBoone.com and Josh Boone Show on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm sure I'll come right up.
There we go. What do you talk about on the podcast? Because the one I listened to was a straight recording of one of your, I don't know if it was client or friend talks, but it was about ADHD. But I've seen you also have, you have doctors on there. You have people who've gone through some serious trauma. You have had other fellow entrepreneurs who face mental challenges. Like, what's kind of like the main thing about your show?
I think It's relatively loose. It's kind of my version of the Joe Rogan show. That's why I call it the Josh Boone show. I didn't give it a name because that was a very intentional decision. I mean, branding and positioning is what I do for a living. And to me, the long goal was just making it about me. And what I mean by that is like, it's whatever the hell I find interesting. Yeah. And whatever topics and people I find interesting, I didn't want to give it a name because I knew eventually that name would be too much of a pigeonhole. Like it would keep me kind of contained. So that was an intentional decision. But really, I mean, at the end of the day, it's me kind of scratching my own itch, just wanting to talk with people that I feel like might have something to teach me, I can learn, or I just like having these intellectual jam sessions with. So, I'll have some people on that are like, you know, really interesting, like the one Dr. Mark Verbruggen. He's like one of the world's experts on foraging, like going out and like foraging like different plants and stuff like that. I had no idea anything about that. He taught me so much stuff about like rewilding, like trying to reestablish permaculture in your backyard, all this crazy stuff. Like, you know, I've talked with just really interesting people. So I think the commonality is just either A, talking with people that are kind of these like obscure experts in these kind of fringe areas and seeing how that colors their worldview. And that's been really interesting, talking with like people that are in like buyer psychology, you know, like on marketing, but how that colors their worldview, you know, as a person, you know, looking at society, or a doctor or something like that. And the other is just like with my buddy Sam McNerney having these kind of weird, deep philosophical conversations. So yeah, I don't know. It's a lot of things.
Yeah, dude. What I took from that, I really like words. I really like writing, talking, anything to do with words. And I have a combination on my notes app of, well, one, I've been doing this for years, but like all the quotes I collect, I like. But then I have one section for like words and phrases I like. And you just said two in one sentence. Intellectual jam sesh. Never heard that before. That's awesome. And then obscure experts is another one. I'm noticing a lot of the patterns of the words praise I like is two words that don't normally go together. And it's like an adjective and a noun, like obscure expert.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just something pretty cool. But yeah. Yeah, that's something.
Yeah, I've got a file that's probably like 40, maybe like 20 pages deep at this point. For my own positioning, you know, my own marketing, where I'm just accumulating all these ideas and all these messaging. It's the same thing I do for clients. Like it's kind of just like a swipe file of all these different ideas and examples and stuff. And it's just growing and growing and it's hard, you know? I mean, I think that's one of the things is that the podcasting is evolving at such a rate. And also my interests as a podcaster have been slowly changing and evolving. So it's just going to be this same thing's going to happen with you. It's just going to be this ongoing relationship of your show kind of slowly pivoting with you. And
yeah, I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
I see it already.
Well, this is an awesome second jam session and hope we do more down the road, man.
Of course, dude. Thanks for coming on, Josh. Maybe I'll go on the Josh Boone show when I become an obscure expert.
Let's do it.
All right. See you, dude.
Later, man. And that is it for this episode. A couple things before I let you go. If you're on the audio-only feed, all of these conversations are now on YouTube. So you can just look up The Josh Boone Show and you can subscribe on there if you're into watching podcasts. When I'm editing these and I'm seeing the video, I often feel like there's a ton of context that you guys are missing out on when you're only audio-only. The second thing is if you use Apple Podcasts, if you could take just 30 seconds and just give us a really quick review, it would mean the fucking world to me. That's really going to help us a lot go up in the podcast rankings, and it'll make it a lot easier for me to be able to book some of my dream guests I want to have on for you guys. And lastly, if you enjoyed this episode and you think you know somebody that might enjoy it too, please share it along. Word of mouth is really how this thing's going to grow. And I am eternally grateful for all y'all that have been sharing it up until now. And if you have any comments or ideas, just drop us a line at show@joshboone.com. And I'd love to hear from you guys. Until next time, peace, y'all.